Are you paying your fair share of taxes?
I feel I'm taxed fairly. I live on a modest income and always have.
I feel like I'm getting a raw deal.
I don't think I pay enough.
I feel that I pay a significant share in taxes.
I would be willing to pay more taxes if it would provide health care for everybody in the United States.
Way too much taxes.
It's not too little. It's not too much.
The majority of Americans believe they're paying their fair share, according to a Gallup survey from last year. The top frustration with the American tax system is that corporations and the wealthy don't.
I don't think a lot of millionaires and billionaires pay what they should.
I don't think that people who make more than me pay their fair share. Income taxes should be exponential.
Nobody making as much as the top 10% has any need for that much accumulated wealth.
The people who need the money most pay the most in taxes.
What gets me the most is that the wealthy people we hear about don't care to pay their fair share. I'm sorry to point out the current president as an example, but he is a notorious tax evader.
President Donald Trump's family is the subject of a New York Times investigation revealing that of the $1 billion in wealth Fred Trump transferred to his children, the Trumps paid just 5% tax on that money instead of the 55% tax rate that was in place at the time. But the Trumps aren't the only ones skirting the tax laws. According to the latest data from the Internal Revenue Service, the tax gap is an estimated $458 billion. That means that between the years 2008 and 2010, that was the average annual difference between what Americans pay in taxes and what they actually owe. Again, for the people in the back, $458 billion with a B. That amount of money would erase more than half of our federal deficit. We could almost pay for the whole Medicaid program with $458 billion. And that difference is likely even higher now. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. In order to figure out whether fair is even attainable in the federal tax system, I'm joined by two guests. David Stasavage, Dean for Social Sciences at New York University and author of Taxing the Rich. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Vanessa Williamson, a fellow in governance studies at Brookings. Vanessa, great to have you with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So, Vanessa, you get the first fun question. Let's talk about the actual tax code. Who is this tax code designed to serve?
Well, the tax code is in part an intentional document, in part a series of historical accidents, and in part the result of, like all laws, lobbying by interest groups, and of course, especially high-powered, high-resourced interest groups.
And is it supposed to be complicated, Vanessa?
Well, I think it's unavoidable that the tax code would be complicated because the economy is complicated, right? But the tax code is, of course, more complicated than it would need to be because it is the product of law and of legislation and of political fights. So, you know, it is in the interest of wealthy people who would like to avoid their taxes, to pick one obvious example, for the law to be written in a complex way, which gives them more flexibility to avoid paying taxes.
David, 6 in 10 Americans that were surveyed in 2015 by the Pew Research Center said that they were bothered by a feeling that, quote, some wealthy people and some corporations do not pay their fair share in taxes. Tell us if that's actually true. Is the idea of what's fair even something that we can achieve under this current tax code?
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing about that figure is that that's been shown in survey after survey that there's a substantial majority of Americans who believe that the tax code, the tax system is biased in favor of the wealthy. And it's not just progressives, it's not just Democrats. A substantial minority of Republicans also, if you know, they self-identify as that on the survey, say the tax code's biased in favor of the wealthy. So if we're talking about fairness, though, one of the key things I think we've got to recognize is that there are different standards of fairness. And people may all agree that the system is biased in favor of the wealthy, but they may not agree on what the best alternative is.
And I'm wondering, Vanessa, we hear a lot about who does pay taxes. To David's point, there's a perception that the wealthy don't pay taxes. Do you know who's actually paying what in this current system?
Well, a good rule of thumb for the tax system as a whole, and that's not just the federal income tax system, but we got to remember there are gas taxes, sales taxes, payroll taxes, all different kinds of taxes that people pay. Many of those taxes fall heavily on lower income people, so it's good to remember the full range of taxes. So the rule of thumb I use is if you're in the bottom 20% of earners, you're paying about a fifth of your income in taxes. If you're in the middle 20% of earners, you're paying about a fourth of your income in taxes. And if you're in the top 20% of earners, you're paying about a third. But once you get to, say, the top 1%, 0.1%, 0.01%, then the tax system stops being progressive, right? We stop seeing those fractions go up, and we start seeing them curve back down. And the question really is how much they curve down. And that's really a question of how much income people who are millionaires many, many, many times over are capable of sort of disguising.
David, I want to give you an example. Who pays more of these two people? An employee making $100,000 a year, or someone who's living off an inheritance and reports $100,000 a year in income from their investments?
Well, one of the things that's clear in our system is that if you're an employee, the IRS is going to know how much you make. Your company gives you a W-2 that they also give to the IRS. And so it's really, really hard to avoid taxes. Now, if you're making income from inheritance, you should, in theory, there are ways around it, but you should, in theory, be paying taxes on income just like anybody else would. But there's no automatic reporting mechanism, and you may have money located abroad or in ways that are not easily seen. And so when it's difficult to track, it's possible that the IRS is missing something.
That doesn't seem too fair. I'm talking with David Stasavage, author of Taxing the Rich, and Vanessa Williams from the Brookings Institution. This is The Takeaway. Vanessa, I started out by talking about the tax gap. And there's this number, the $458 billion that we are missing, essentially. If the federal government could get this money back, how would that impact us in this country?
Well, I think there are two ways of thinking about that, right? One is the one thing you brought up at the beginning of the show, the idea of what would that money pay for? And it would pay for a very large and important program, you know, most of Medicaid, let's say, right? So we can look at it that way. Where else could that money have gone? Or we could do the full comparison and say, is that money more valuable? Is it more efficient or effective to have that money in the hands of people who already have millions and millions of dollars? Or would that money be better spent somewhere else, right? And I think that, you know, these are really quite large numbers. They have very large implications.
At what point did this system start to favor, if you will, wealthier Americans? Or has that always been built into the tax code?
Well, I think it's worth recognizing that the federal income tax was originally what was called a class tax. That is, it only applied to very, very rich people. No one else had to fill out a form or anything. It becomes what's called a mass tax so that more money could be raised for World War II. And that's when you start to see, you know, vastly more people having to keep track of their income. Now, the American federal income tax has always been progressive in terms of its rates, right? The rates go up as you make more money, the marginal tax rate, it goes up. But almost as soon as you start having a federal income tax, you start having organizing by wealthy interests to find ways around it, right? So that's been a back-and-forth battle the whole time. I just wanted to follow up on something David said, which I absolutely agree with. One thing that makes our tax code so complicated in the United States is that we try and do a lot of social policy through it, right? We try and reward homeowning or going to college, or we try and subsidize wages for low-income workers, and all of those things also make the tax code complex, even for people who don't have complex earnings.
Well, and it seems like we really do seem to favor certain types of institutions. Like, for example, people who are single don't usually get a tax break, right? Like people who are married, people who are not homeowners, people who are not parents, for example. But there's also bigger loopholes, right? Things like how the wealthy are able to hide some of this money or invest it. You mentioned capital gains, for example. Tell us some ways in which wealthier Americans can sort of work around what the rest of us are paying.
Well, yeah. I mean, the reason why we get this effect that Vanessa was talking about, where once you start earning very, very high incomes, your effective tax rate, the tax rate you actually pay, starts to go down.
And where is that? What's that point usually?
That's somewhere around $5 million a year in annual income, so pretty high. The reason for that, it's because it's not, you know, it's loopholes that are completely legal generally. It's not, you wouldn't even call it a loophole. A lot of it has to do with the fact that people who are very high earners are making different types of income. Maybe they're getting income that can be classified as capital gains. We tax capital gains at a lower rate than we do ordinary income of the sort that you'd be getting if you're just having a salary and getting a W-2.
And capital gains, for folks like me who sometimes forget what that means, that's money through investments, right?
That's money through investments, Susie. A realization of a gain on an investment you had made that is appreciated. And there can be legitimate economic reasons for treating capital gains differentially, say if you want people to invest and boost the economy. But it does have this alternative consequence of saying that once you're talking about very, very high earners, they're actually paying less. And so that's why you get Warren Buffett saying that he's paying a lower tax rate than his secretary.
Vanessa, who does the IRS tend to go after? I think that was a big question with this Trump story, right? Was now the New York State taxes authorities are looking into what Trump and his family could have done. But is the IRS more likely to go after a small, you know, earner who might have made a mistake on their taxes rather than these big corporate giants?
What I'd say is that it's easy for the IRS to see certain kinds of mistakes, right? Because they get money from your employer if you are paid a wage. They get money and then they get the information from your employer. They get the information from you. They can compare it. Very simple. Trying to figure out the schemes that we saw in the New York Times with Donald Trump, I mean, that took a team of reporters at the New York Times 18 months, right? And we've been cutting IRS funding for decades. So it's just really hard work that we don't prioritize in our federal budget.
18 months and I think 100,000 pages of documents and three very brilliant reporters. I want to thank you both. David Stasavage is Dean for Social Sciences at New York University and author of Taxing the Rich, A History of Fiscal Fairness in the United States and Europe. David, thank you.
Thank you.
And Vanessa Williamson is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Vanessa, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Last week, when Brett Kavanaugh took the stand in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he addressed a document from his teenage years.
For one thing, our yearbook was a disaster. I think some editors and students wanted the yearbook to be some combination of Animal House, Caddyshack, and Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which were all recent movies at that time. Many of us went along in the yearbook to the point of absurdity.
Kavanaugh's Georgetown Prep yearbook has become the subject of public debate in recent weeks. But he says the yearbook doesn't reflect what he was like in high school. Instead, he said it indicates what movies were popular at the time. Well, we've got two movie critics here in the studio, and we're going to talk about what teenagers like Brett Kavanaugh were watching in the 80s. Rafer Guzman is the film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Hey, Rafer.
Hey, Tanzina.
And Allison Wilmore is a critic and culture writer for BuzzFeed. Hi, Allison.
Hey there.
So let's get into it. We started off the segment with that wonderful song from The Breakfast Club, which is one of my problematic faves, by the way. But we're talking about the 80s. And for those of us who don't remember the 80s, tell us, what was the landscape like back then, Rafer?
Oh, you had to come to me, didn't you, for that?
I did. I wanted to be gentle with Allison.
Well,
yes.
Look, I was there. I was there for The Breakfast Club. I was there for 16 Candles. You know, those movies, I know they've come under fire lately for some of the things that have been depicted in them. Although you have to remember at the time, they were a little bit of a reaction to movies that were even worse, like Porky's and things like that, or something like Zapped with Scott Baio, where he, you know, develops telekinesis and can go around lifting women's skirts.
Yes.
Hilarious.
Apparently, in the 80s.
Right. So, you know, the John Hughes movies were at the time, I think, thought of as very sensitive, a little bit kind of radical, especially The Breakfast Club, which was just teenagers sitting around in a room talking, which no one had ever seen anything like that before. But the real, you know, the guiding principle, I think, of a teen film at the time was going to be a lot of women's bodies and a lot of, you know, sex behind the gym and rowdy and rambunctious and very hormonally driven.
Allison, you're nodding your head. As a woman watching these films, what was your take on that?
Well, I grew up with them afterwards, seeing them on TV. Kind of, they were, I think, like standards on basic cable forever. I think you could flick on a TV on a Saturday and one of them would be on there. You know, I think for me, I was kind of trying to figure out how to be a teenager. And I think you watch movies like this and you're like, is that how it's going to go? And you watch it with a mixture of kind of understanding and skepticism. You know, I think Molly Ringwald, who is, of course, the star of a lot of these, has written really interestingly looking back on these movies now. And she has said that they're also sort of a reaction to the kind of after-school specials. You know, a lot of teenagers are like, I don't want to get lectured and being told these warnings. So it was also, in some of the ways, like you were supposed to be seeing people act out, behave in ways that you didn't otherwise get to see.
And we asked on Twitter, I asked yesterday for people to share their problematic faves with us, and the movie 16 Candles came up a lot. So particularly because of its depiction of dating and sex and what a lot of people would call rape culture, let's play a clip from the movie. This is Jake Ryan talking about his girlfriend, Caroline.
I got Caroline in the bedroom right now, passed out cold. I could violate her 10 different ways if I wanted to.
What are you waiting for?
I don't know. She's beautiful and she's built and all that. I'm just not interested anymore.
Allison, I mean, did anyone pay attention to that dialogue in 1984, do you think?
I can't speak for that time, but I, as someone who watched it, I remember that line just kind of like searing itself on my brain because he, you know, Jake Ryan is like the dreamboat. He is the aspirational figure. And this is how he talks about his girlfriend at the time. I think it's really difficult not to hear that, at least as a woman, to hear that and not kind of think like, oh, is that what I need to watch out for? Like, is that what I need to avoid to be seen as like, you know, in this dichotomy of how women are as good or bad? Is that what you need to choose?
And Rafer, I'm thinking, is it fair to say that these movies are showing us like how teenagers actually acted at the time or what attitudes towards sexual assault were like? Because in the Kavanaugh hearings we heard at the top of the show, he suggested that they were just imitating this. It wasn't real life.
Yeah, I think those movies were all combination of a little bit of realism and a lot of fantasy and wish fulfillment.
Wish fulfillment.
Okay, let's be clear.
Let's be clear, just checking.
Yeah, no, you're right. I will answer the question that you asked, Allison, and I would say nobody raised any objection to this back then. I never heard, I was a teenager at the time. I never heard anyone say anything about any of that. This was the way that the older kids behaved in your mind, and that was cool, and we all knew sort of what guys were like, and women had to know what guys were like, and that was kind of how it was. You know, I personally was never a fan of 16 Candles kind of for that reason. I mean, there's a lot of things in that movie that I do like, but the Jake character, I was always a little bit miffed as a kid that all the girls were falling over Jake, and I always kept thinking, what's so great about that guy aside from the fact that he looks really good? He doesn't seem that different from any of the villains to me. And one of the things that I think is interesting is that, you know, that character has remained the dreamboat for decades. And it is really only recently that everyone, women included, kind of snapped to and said, hey, wait a minute, I've kind of forgotten about that whole scene.
And we did actually get a lot of reaction yesterday to this tweet. I asked people about some of the movies they loved that they now think are cringeworthy, and I'll read some of those to you. So we had journalist Jeff Yang, who's been on The Takeaway. He said, everything John Hughes, but especially 16 Candles. He also mentioned Revenge of the Nerds, which came up a lot. Anna Sale, the host of Death, Sex, and Money, said Heathers. One commenter, Deshelle Eve, said, just rewatched Grease with my daughter, and the misogyny is pretty out of control. Allison, your thoughts on any of those? I mean, we've already talked about 16 Candles, but Revenge of the Nerds?
Oh, Revenge of the Nerds, I think, you know, when you watch it, that also, you know, 16 Candles, I think, in some ways tries to ground itself in, there are parts where it's a teenage girl's fantasy about kind of getting chosen by, you know, the hottest guy at school. But I think Revenge of the Nerds is like a very kind of like, you know, powerful male fantasy also about what you're allowed to do as underdogs, you know, and about women as like point system, essentially, that, you know, proof of your virility and your success and something that you deserve. And I think that idea has had a real hold on people that is has not been good.
I also think that, you know, when we were talking about Grease earlier, and I think that, you know, just I was saying, you know, the ideal was to look like Olivia Newton-John, be blonde, beautiful, right? Very. There were also some ways that women were expected to behave in a lot of these films. But going past the 80s, you know, how have teenagers evolved in film? I think about the film Kids in the 90s, right? That's really different from the John Hughes genre. So
sure.
Where are we today when it comes to teenagers in film?
I think we are actually in a really great place, to be honest. I really feel like there are a lot of voices coming out that are very genuine, non-condescending, people who I think are reaching back into their teenage years and trying to bring something very real that talks to kids on their own level. I would think of something like The Edge of 17, one of my favorite movies in recent years, Eighth Grade, which I know everyone's talking about. I'll tip my hand a little bit, but The Hate U Give, which comes out tomorrow, I think it is. Not a perfect film, but that is a film that is talking directly to teenagers, particularly teenagers of color, but I think all teenagers in a really straightforward, honest, great way. And so I think that teen films have really in some ways caught up and certainly surpassed the old ones.
Rafer, you mentioned things like Edge of 17, which is a film I love, and Diary of a Teenage Girl, which I don't know that I would say I would recommend for teenagers. It's very grown up, but I think has like this wonderful female character. And, you know, and I think you're seeing more women directors come in and bring like a very, you feel their perspective there. You know, and a lot of people were talking about, and I think it's a really interesting movie, To All the Boys I Loved Before, which is a Netflix romantic comedy. And that movie like explicitly cites 16 Candles. The characters watch it and one of them is like, isn't this kind of racist? And the other is like, a lot racist, but Jake Ryan, you know? And I think that that is a representation of maybe a lot of the ways we look back at these movies now to be like, maybe we want to take some parts and discard some parts. And in that movie, you know, you've got a kind of update of Jake Ryan and he's a little less problematic.
And that's my question really too, is what do we do with these films? You know, this often happens in culture, as you know, we have cycles and then we evolve and then we look back and we say, well, I don't know, but we still watch movies from the silent era and the golden era of Hollywood. So are these movies something we can't touch anymore, Rafer?
I think you have to make a distinction with some of these movies. You know, something, to use an obvious example, Birth of a Nation can't really be entertainment anymore. That's just got to be an artifact that you examine and turn over and look at and discuss like a pottery shard or something. You can't just sit and have popcorn and enjoy that film, whereas I think you still could with 16 Candles, with the listeners recommended Grease, which I also just showed to my two boys who are 8 and 10. And I did have to tell them, like, listen, the ending of this film is a little odd. You know, the fact that Olivia Newton-John decides that she has to become something of a juvenile delinquent and wear this, you know, cat suit and become extremely sexually aggressive and discard her old personality seems a little weird. And, you know, I think if you warn your kids ahead of time and keep these things in mind and put these things in context, they can still work. Grease is still a pretty great musical and my kids loved it, but I'm glad I gave them that talk.
What do you think, Allison?
Well, I've never been a fan of suggesting we discard, you know, history because it doesn't fit with how we've changed. I think it's good to look back and understand how we've changed. And I think it's okay to look back at something and both kind of enjoy the parts that hold up and to, you know, maybe cringe a bit at the parts that don't. You know, I really do think that, like, looking back at something like 16 Candles is illuminating in the ways in which you're like, this bypassed every kind of gatekeeper of, you know, to get it made. And no one commented on these things.
Or maybe they all agreed with it.
Right.
I mean, you know, they rubber stamped it, right? Because at the time it was considered okay.
Yeah. And, you know, Molly Ringwald has talked about being like, oh, I didn't like that, but I didn't say anything, you know? And I think that it is good to understand that because I think that also reflects on how we've changed.
Rafer Guzman is the film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, and Allison Wilmore is a critic and culture writer for BuzzFeed. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free, Babbel.com.
When the national media talks about rural populations in the United States, they usually mean white people.
The American white working class makes up the core of Donald Trump's support.
McDowell County was unambiguously Trump country.
Loyalty, unease in Trump's Midwest.
They all appear to be retaliating against industries affected by Trump country.
Working class whites.
But with all the focus on white rural voters who turned out for Donald Trump, another important group of constituents is usually ignored.
There are Black people living outside of cities, living mostly in the South, and living in red states, right? So the Black Belt overlaps with Trump country. And those are the folks that are really going to factor into elections across the South in these midterm elections.
That's Erin Haynes-Wack, and she's the Associated Press national writer on race and ethnicity. And recently, she's been reporting from rural counties in Georgia in part of what's called the Black Belt.
The Black Belt is the what we know as the Deep South, which, you know, historically is where slavery thrived, where, you know, the wealth of the plantation system was created. And obviously, when slavery went away, these became some of the most impoverished areas in the country. But the Black Belt is also where, frankly, the battle for voting rights for African Americans was waged. And so, you know, you think about Fannie Lou Hamer or Ella Jo Baker, Fred Shuttlesworth, John Lewis. These people weren't from Baltimore or Cleveland or New York. You know, they were from the Deep South and they expanded that franchise for all. And, you know, this is also the place where issues like voter suppression continue and persist today. And so that's one of the reasons why it's really important to focus on these folks and how they're going to factor into November.
And you mentioned voter suppression. Tell us a little bit about some of the other issues that are really top of mind for Black working class rural Americans.
Because a lot of these areas are poor, they struggle with economic development opportunities a lot more than urban areas. But they also have healthcare challenges, specifically. As we know, minorities often have healthcare disparities from diabetes to sickle cell to obesity, but they don't necessarily have the access to healthcare that you would have, say, in a city. You can have dozens and dozens of churches, for example, but no hospitals for miles and miles. And that's a real challenge for them and something that has not been addressed, frankly, by the folks that get elected in those parts of the country a lot of times.
And in your piece, you went to Georgia to report this out. Why did you choose that state?
Well, Georgia was really, really important because in Georgia, there is obviously a very high-profile gubernatorial contest where possibly the first African-American woman could be elected governor in the country, and that's Stacey Abrams. And Stacey Abrams actually started her campaign in South Georgia, where a lot of these Black rural voters live. And the reason that that's important is because, you know, about a third of the rural folks in Georgia are people of color. And so unlike other contests, local contests, for example, that may be dilute the power of people of color, frankly, because of racial gerrymandering, you know, in a statewide contest, these are the voters that could really be key to those kinds of victories. And frankly, you know, what she has done going to a lot of these places that have been forgotten, you know, by Democrats in recent cycles could make the difference in that contest and others in the South where you have large populations of Black folks, especially in rural counties.
Erin, one thing that comes across in your piece is that the Black rural populations that you spoke to felt disaffected by politics. That seems to be shifting, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one thing that's important to think about for these folks is because they felt like they were electing people who were forgetting about them kind of in between election times. You know, they were voting for people who then did not come back and give them, like I said, the economic development that they were looking for or the health care that they need. And so they felt like, at least in these off presidential year elections, that their vote didn't count. You know, you've got now folks who look like them running in more of these places. In several of these counties that I went to, you have incumbents who've, you know, been in office for years, in some cases, even white conservative lawmakers at the local level, representing majority Black counties. And I wondered, you know, how is that possible? Well, these people have gone unchallenged for so long, or people, you know, have not paid attention really to those local level elections. And so these people have stayed in office. But now that's starting to change as folks are starting to get more engaged in these local down ballot races and realizing that, that they can also make a difference.
Right. And what's interesting also is that I interviewed Sarah Smarsh, who's a journalist, a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about how white progressive rural voters feel that their perspectives have been forgotten in the Trump country narrative, right?
Sure.
Did rural black voters also feel like they were being left out of the media narrative, or was that just something that wasn't even a concern for them?
No, I think it definitely is a concern because, you know, I brought this up to them, you know, doing my reporting, and a lot of them nodded their heads in agreement. You know, they're not front of mind when you think about rural voters or even farmers. I mean, black people, there's never been a time in this country when black people have not been connected to the land. And so the idea that somehow we have been distanced from that narrative is really interesting to me. I mean, I'm from the South, and so obviously for me, that's not something that's foreign, but for a lot of folks that are in cities and maybe, you know, either don't have relatives or aren't getting back to that part of the country to see family or friends, it doesn't always occur to folks that, yes, there are black people living in rural areas and quite a lot of them, frankly.
I'm curious if you think there could be the potential for coalitions to be formed between, say, more progressive white rural voters and rural black voters who might be able to see some opportunities there for cross-pollination, if you will, of ideas? Or is that just too, is it too early to tell right now?
Well, you know, I think it's entirely possible. And I say that because, again, when you're in a small place like that, you know, these are folks that are interacting so much. I mean, not to suggest there are still places like that where there is segregation and people are living in different parts of town, but the town is so much smaller than, say, a big city. And so these are folks that really do know each other. You know, I think of a recent campaign stop that Stacey Abrams had down in Plains, Georgia, which is the hometown of former President Jimmy Carter. And, you know, the idea that the two of them would be on the campaign trail together, President Carter has endorsed her, they're talking about rural health care, that's something that affects both those progressive white rural voters and black rural voters. And so, you know, understanding that they do have shared interests, I think does present an opportunity for just that kind of coalition that you talk about.
Erin Haynes-Wack is the Associated Press national writer on race and ethnicity. Erin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
When a woman is a victim of domestic violence, finding a way out is not easy. But for immigrant women, especially those who are undocumented, things can be even more complicated. In fact, immigrant women are nearly twice as likely as the general population to experience domestic violence. These women may not be aware of the legal options available to them, or those options themselves may be limited. Many of them say they fear deportation if they contact authorities. Over the last several decades, a secretive network of Latinas has sprung up in California to help those suffering from domestic abuse.
Women who essentially opened their homes as shelters for abused women.
Lizzie Presser is a contributing writer for California Sunday Magazine, and she reported on this underground network of women giving abused immigrants safety, companionship, and even medical and legal advice. Presser says there are about 150 other Latina women nationwide doing work similar to what she saw in California. And she told me about one of the women she followed in her reporting.
So I follow a woman named Valentina, and she's opening her home, and one of the women who she's working with is a woman who I call Sylvia. She has been in an abusive relationship for many years, and for a while, she was struggling to leave because she was nervous about just going public with her story at all. Since Trump was elected, she became much more nervous about the threat of deportation, and in particular about losing her children. And so she came to Valentina's house and stayed for a week, and now Valentina sees her regularly to check in on her. And she understands that this is a long process, right? You know, on average, a woman tries 7 times to leave her abusive partner in this country, right? When you're an immigrant woman, that can be even more difficult.
What is a U visa? And how does it play into this conversation we're having?
I'll step back a little. So the Violence Against Women Act was first passed in 1994, and it was the first federal legislative package that was designed to end violence against women. And it included a piece of legislation that provided a path to permanent residency for abused immigrant women whose spouses were their abusers and who were also U.S. citizens or permanent residents. It's a really small fraction of immigrant women. In 2000, with the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, that was expanded and the U visa was created. And it offered a path to permanent residency for immigrant women who were victims of violent crime and who were willing to help with the investigation or prosecution of that crime. It was bipartisan legislation. So the U visa is that.
Where does it stand today?
In the past 4 years, we've seen an enormous backlog grow. In 2014, the government was granting U visas to women who had applied 5 months earlier. If you apply today, you will wait 9 years for a U visa. There's an 120,000 person backlog, so they're capped at 10,000 a year. And in the same time frame, we've seen the number of adjudicators drop from 93 to 60 at the last official tally.
Why is there such a delay? And is that delay what's spurring these women in part to seek services, quote unquote, underground?
It's hard to understand why there's such a delay and why there hasn't been a surplus or an addition of adjudicators to help speed up the process. It's a good question about whether that delay is driving people underground. Of course, we don't know causation necessarily, but definitely the women who I was speaking to who were opening their homes were finding that survivors who came to them just didn't want to wait 9 years. They couldn't wait 9 years, right? So that means that for 9 years, they don't have the protections of a work permit. So they can't necessarily support their children. And that's what the U visa was designed to do, to give people a pathway to residency so that they would be able to leave safely and to support their families.
And, you know, the Obama administration had very controversial policies regarding immigration. I'm wondering, are these women more concerned under today's circumstances under the Trump administration, or was there equal concern under the Obama administration? If so, what's the difference today?
I was wondering the same thing, and I was actually somewhat surprised to learn that this concern is much, much higher today than it was under Obama's administration.
The concern of deportation?
The concern of deportation. Mm-hmm. A lot of the women who were coming to these safe houses, essentially, under the Obama administration didn't feel as if it was as risky to come forward to the police. They felt as if Obama's deportation priorities were much clearer. And now those priorities have been widened so broadly that they really just don't know. One of the other things I heard a lot in this reporting was that women felt particularly afraid about separation of families. It's just all over the news in this way that they believe that it's possible that their family too could be separated.
When these women come to Valentina, do they end up staying just temporarily? Do they end up going back to their abusive partners? Like, what have you seen?
Yeah, so Valentina estimates that about half of the women who have stayed with her have gone back to their partners. It's really, really difficult to leave, and half have left. Some stay for a night. Some stay for 2 months. So it really depends on the woman, and Valentina's feeling is it's up to them, and she'll do what works best for them. I mean, I met some women who were opening their homes who found that the survivors stayed with them for as long as a year. One of the problems with the shelter system is that there's an expiration date. If you are lucky enough to find a bed in a shelter, which is extremely hard to do, you often have 60 or 90 days maximum, and then you have to get out. And so these women feel like the least they can do is kind of extend that stay.
Why does the network need to be a secret?
Some of the women don't necessarily call it a secret and would actually speak about it more publicly. Others feel as if it's too risky to say, I'm bringing in women whose partners are abusing them, because they feel as if there's a possibility that abuser will then come after them. Some of these women have kids they're living with, you know, and they're trying to protect their families and they're trying to protect their communities. And in part, it's because the survivors themselves want to disappear. They feel as if they can't get a restraining order, they don't feel safe going to the police, they can't get a restraining order, they don't want to live in the same cities as their abusers. They prefer to move to a different town and start a new life. And so they would prefer if their location was secret. And so the women who are opening their homes respect and honor that.
Is there anything we should be thinking about culturally, because we're talking about Latinas in particular? Are there any cultural distinctions that come up in dealing with domestic violence?
There's so much work that needs to be done at the ground level just to get women to feel comfortable talking among people who they know about what's going on in their home or what's going on in the workplace. And we can't be failing to see that. We can't be missing that.
Lizzie Presser is a contributing writer for California Sunday Magazine. Lizzie, thanks for your reporting.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's our show for the day. We wanted to take a moment to say goodbye to Liz Ross. Liz has been a producer on the show for 9 years, and today is her last day with us. But she's still making radio, and you can hear her work on WGBH's Innovation Hub. We'll miss you, Liz. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
We want you to be part of The Takeaway's Listener Response Network. We'll send you a few text messages a week about topics we're discussing on our show. To sign up, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply, and you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, text START to 69866 to join our conversation every day. You can also connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram. We're at The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.